A pretty bold statement for an ensign. With only 2 months space duty under his belt?
I am aware of my limited experience, but I am also very much aware of Starfleet regulations and my obligation to carry them out.
That's enough. Ensign, you're relieved. I'm sorry about this, Captain. I assure you it will not happen again.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, enduring patriarchal society with the bravest face that I can.
And now for this week's conundrum, Janice Rand, what could have been?
Cam, this is obviously a character who I think was meant for bigger things. Mm-hmm. If you look at where Gene Roddenberry wanted to take her.
Yeah.
And I think maybe we should discuss the fact, okay, she's a yeoman. There's that tension between her and Kirk. Grace Lee Whitney was quickly written out of the series. She mm-hmm. appeared in, I think, about 13 episodes. Is that about right?
It was eight.
Eight episodes?
Okay,
yeah. So less than half.
She's on the show up until, I think, episode 13.
Okay.
But she only appears in a sporadic number.
So she appears in less than half of season one. But,
right.
And she left under some pretty troubling circumstances. Mm-hmm. They go into detail about that in Grace Lee Whitney's book.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should just be upfront. Like, she was, like, sexually assaulted by an executive at NBC. And just a few days later, she was told that her character was being written out of the show.
Yeah.
Grace Lee Whitney connects these two events, and but Gene Roddenberry had said in the past that the executives wanted to push for Kirk having girlfriends of the week, and so they did not want this ongoing tension between Kirk and Janice Rand.
Yeah, I mean, she got the call at the end of filming the episode Miri, and was told, like, hey, you're out, and, you know... one of her final appearances, I think the last episode she shot was The Conscience of a King, where she doesn't even speak. She just walks out of out of the turbo lift as Kirk's love interest of the week is walking towards it, and she just kind of gives her a dirty look. And it's really like a sad, mean-spirited note to go out on, even though it was, like, Balance of Terror was aired after. So in terms of the airing order, that's not the way it is, but it's just like a really ugly way to end an actor's reign, you know, like, I think there's a lot of comparisons we'll make. Maybe we'll get to this later in the show, talking about her versus Denise Crosby as a character. But I think Janice Rand is really, really fascinating within the world of Star Trek, because when Grace Lee Whitney was brought onto the show, she was an actress of some note. She'd done a lot of TV work, and she was discovered by Billy Wilder. She was a dancer, she was a singer, and an actress, and she was brought in by him, and she had a role in the band. In Some Like It Hot, the classic Marilyn Monroe comedy with Jack Lemmon, Tony Curtis. She was also in Irma La Douce, which not as popular as Some Like It Hot, but also a big movie with Jack Lemmon and Shirley MacLaine. And she worked with Roddenberry on The Lieutenant, and also a pilot he was putting together called Police Story. It didn't shoot with her, but Roddenberry liked her so much, he was like, I want you for Star Trek. And when the show was envisioned, the three leads were Kirk, Spock, and Rand. And, you know, a lot of the promotional material for season one really does give that impression. She is very front and center. I mean, the beehive hairdo is iconic. And I think it's very easy for a viewer now to start the original series and get the impression that, like, Janice Rand is a major character, because she's very significant within the first handful of episodes. She has a very iconic look. People know and emulate at conventions and so forth.
So before I ever really started watching the original series, I watched the films, and it was very easy for me to deduce who the core cast was based mm-hmm. on those films. But going back and rewatching, I'm going into a deep dive of season one of TOS right now, and it's very obvious to me that Janice Rand was meant to be one of the core characters there.
Mm-hmm.
I think even at this point where I am in season one of the original series, she's a more developed character than I would say Uhura is, Sulu as well. Mm-hmm. Maybe Scotty has a little bit on her, but mm-hmm. other than that, it's very obvious that she's, you know, one of the big characters of the show.
Yeah, and one of the great tragedies, and something I'd like to talk kind of about this episode, is how this character, who, by all accounts, essentially, was intended as a very crucial member of this cast, ultimately has become a character that, like, AV Club, in their writings of TOS, referred to her as one of Trek's most egregious offenses against feminism. So this is a character with a lot of really troubling baggage, both on-screen and off-screen. And Grace Lee Whitney, you know, the actress who played her, went through hell for, you know, obviously this incident, and then afterwards spiraling into alcoholism and a really, really unfortunate life for about 20 years before she, you know, was able to pull herself together in the early 80s and lived a very positive, you know, life after that. But, you know, this character is someone who was not treated well on the show, and the actress was not treated well really on set by a lot of the people there. Shatner and a lot of the cast seemed fairly almost unaware as to what was going on, at least in interviews. I don't really know. I'm not inside their heads, so I really can't say. But I know she has, Grace Lee Whitney has said that Nimoy, who was her acting coach on the show to help her kind of get in character, was like her big supporter, and she said she went to him, you know, after this at all, you know, this terrible incident occurred, and he was really her only ally to talk to at the time. But, you know, so I'm curious, Tyler, going through the series, you know, Janice Rand, what has been sort of your take? Like, is this a character who, when you watch her, you sit there and you go, like, what could have been with this character?
Yeah, and obviously, look, if she'd made it through three seasons, I think it's obvious she would have been in the movies continuing on. Her role would have been fleshed out. She did appear in mm-hmm. a number of the films as well, but she would have been part of that kind of core group. And I think more so, let's be honest, like Uhura, Sulu, they really didn't have that much to do in the films, especially compared with someone like Chekhov,
right?
Which I find fascinating. But I think she would have been far more integrated into the films. But it's kind of disturbing watching a lot of these episodes. You can tell she's supposed to be such an important character, but the way that she's portrayed and the way that she's treated by other characters, it's very clear that we're living in very much a pre-feminist society at that point, where, let's be honest, I mean, Charlie X, he's literally like slapping her on the butt. And he thinks, you know, hey, that's how you get women. And it's kind of, and let's be honest here, like an episode like Enemy Within,
mm-hmm.
where we have the duplicate evil Kirk literally trying to rape her.
Mm-hmm.
Very frightening. I would say that's probably the most disturbing thing I've seen in Star Trek ever.
Yeah, it's definitely near the top of the list. I can think of another one later you're going to get to in the original series. It's also pretty awful. But, you know, let's talk about those episodes and kind of one of the themes of Janice Rand, because with Janice Rand, maybe her biggest theme overall as a character arc is, like, sexual repression. We know that she has this love for Kirk. Like, her and Kirk, we are given the impression that, you know, they would kind of like to be together, but they can't because of duty.
And, well, even Kirk, he's disgruntled by the fact that he has to work with a female yeoman.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, really, dude? But he's somebody who's very much about the uniform and the integrity of the uniform. So I think the reason he's disgruntled is because he's obviously very attracted to this woman.
Yeah, in the episode Naked Time, when he's essentially space drunk, he's like saying, oh, you know, I have this beautiful yeoman. And he gives this, like, this hint. He says something like, no beach to walk on or something. You know, he's essentially implying that, like, in a different life, they could be together.
Right.
And it's not the case. But Janice Rand, it's this whole idea of, like, you know, she has to kind of contain her desire throughout the series. And I don't know that that's a sustainable thing. We'll maybe talk about that in a bit. But that leads to some very ugly material in those two episodes you named. Let's talk a bit about Charlie X first, I think. Because in Charlie X, that introduces the character of Charlie Evans, this kid who's been, you know, raised essentially by aliens and is now encountering humanity for the first time since being a baby. And Janice Rand sort of takes this motherly role to him. And it's very uncomfortable because he's quickly quite be smitten by Janice Rand and expresses himself in ways that would probably get him in jail.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it's kind of played for laughs, and yeah. It's very much treated as like, oh, it's just, it's of the times.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way, look, I mean, Star Trek, very progressive series for the 1960s, but there's no way that this really translates into good quality television nowadays.
No. It really doesn't. And, you know, Charlie, like, is really creepy. He's creepy in a way that is, like, nowadays, I mean, it would be a stalker situation.
Yeah.
He's, like, sneaking into her room and stuff like that, and...
But it's also fascinating to see how a lot of those kinds of similar themes persist throughout the run of, say, Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't... Maybe it's just you and I obviously grew up in a different era, and we're far more... aware of how bad this is.
Yeah.
I can't believe, you know, even when you have, say, DC Fontana in the writer's room at that period of time, is she not, you know, expressing some of the stuff that's very concerning? But maybe also to her? I just keep thinking about this very complex, like, scandal going on in the Canadian literature scene right now with regards to a creative writing professor at the University of British Columbia, who was recently dismissed. I won't go into the details, but Margaret Atwood wrote, famed author Margaret Atwood wrote a letter kind of defending him and attacking this process.
Mm-hmm.
And just the stuff, she's very dismissive about a lot of women who are, you know, alleging like sexual assaults. And a lot of people are trying to defend Margaret Atwood, saying, oh, well, she's a much older woman. She's just not up to these times. And I wonder if that's one of the big issues that we're dealing with here when we look at how the writers portrayed Janice Rand. In a way that I don't see that they treated, say, Uhura.
No, but they did treat, like, say, Troy further down the road, different writing staff. It's sort of this victimizing female characters attitude. But for some reason, like... the Janice Rand, probably because of the times, which are, of course, more outdated even than the 80s, come across as way more brutal. You know, Charlie X is played largely for laughs. What he does is awkward, but, you know, Kirk's going to teach him the ropes by taking off his shirt and wrestling with him. You know, like, it's portrayed more as, like, Kirk's got to teach this kid how to be a man and, you know, just got to kind of iron out the rough edges, which... plays more into sort of those very, very outdated ways of looking at masculinity. And that Charlie just needs a little refining. He's almost there, but, you know, Kirk can show him the ropes. But when you get to, like, The Enemy Within, which is the one you reference, this is the episode where Kirk gets split in two, essentially. And one half is sort of the evil Kirk, or the one that's driven by his id. And there is a sequence in this where he sneaks into Janice Rand's quarters. And he's, like, sipping, like, Saurian brandy. And he attacks her. And it is a brutal sequence.
Well, Cam, it's not that he just attacks her. He attempts to rape her.
Yes.
Like, here's the thing. I was looking at research into this, and I'm really kind of appalled by some of the language a lot of the fans out there use.
What did they say?
Like, he was being amorous.
Oh, wow.
Like, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And honestly, it's like, let's not, like, fool ourselves here. Like, he attempted to rape her. And this is on broadcast television in the 1960s. And it wasn't played by, like, this is the horror of rape. It's played more like, hey, this is the antagonist. And it's also, like, a plot point because she scratches him in the face. And that's how you're able to distinguish him from the real Kirk.
Right, yes.
You know, so it's very disturbing, you know, the way that she's written. And... yeah.
And I rewatched this scene today just because I was like, is this as bad as I remembered it? So I want to rewatch her performance. And I mean, this scene is awful. Mm-hmm. Like, it really is. And, you know, I love the original series. And to me, this moment almost breaks the original series. Like, the tone of that series does not support this moment.
No.
And there's like that moment where she like manages to get to the door and is like screaming to this crew member to get Spock. And it's like, it's really wrenching. And then there's a sequence after where she's essentially describing what happened. It's really, I mean, look, Grace Lee Whitney deserves all the points in the world from my eyes for selling what this character has gone through. The show, you know, at this point has not treated this character with the most gravitas, you could say. You know, in Man Trap, she's like eating like Sulu's food as she delivers it. So, you know, this is not a character we've seen go through these like really severe emotions. But, like, Grace Lee Whitney is selling it, but it is an ugly scene where she's describing what happened. And, you know, she's got, like, streaked mascara. You know, it just looks... What were they thinking?
I'm not sure they were.
Yeah.
I honestly think that they're, like, just sitting at a typewriter thinking, oh, this would be something to push the story along.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I hate saying this, you know, because I think it sounds like it's an excuse, but, I mean, I do think it's a sign of the times.
Right.
And just how behind people were, you know, just 50 sure. years ago.
Well, you know, 2 years before this episode comes out, you have the movie Goldfinger, loved by the world, the James Bond movie that basically causes the franchise to really explode. And there's a scene in that where, like, Bond seduces, quote-unquote, Pussy Galore, and it's by, like, holding her down, and she's, like, trying to get away and, you know, forcing himself essentially upon her. And no one thought that was apparently repellent either. And so it really does speak to the 60s, but there's something, at least the way this is portrayed, is so much more ugly and traumatizing, which maybe it's actually in a way less harmful than the Bond one, because the Bond one actually has a positive outcome. But regardless, it just, to me, it seems like something that you're more like scratch your head, like, why the hell would they have thought that this would be a good idea?
I'll tell you this, though. I mean, even nowadays, I see a lot of stuff on TV mm-hmm. that I realize how clueless a lot of these writers are. Mm-hmm. Cam, you're not a Game of Thrones fan, but there's season 4 and season 5, they both had, like, depictions of sexual assaults that you can just tell, like, how utterly, like, not with it that the writers in the writer's room were. And there's all this outrage, and a lot of people try to defend it, mm-hmm. and it's, like, I even still believe, like, 50 years later, a lot of people just do not get it.
Yeah.
So, let's go back to the character of Janice Rand. I mean, look, the Enemy Within... Very horrifying sequence, of course. But, I mean, beyond that, I mean, what do you think that, if we look beyond her initial appearances on the show, mm-hmm. where do you think that character could have gone? Do you think she would have had, like, this trajectory where she had more upward mobility? We obviously see that in the films, you know, but was she somebody who's going to get some sort of arc? Because they weren't necessarily big on, like, character arcs back in that day.
No.
But she's so... written in a way that I think there's some very obvious room for growth, or else I don't know if we would have wanted to watch 3 seasons of this person who is very much portrayed as a defenseless woman a lot mm-hmm. of the time.
Well, yeah, that was my big question is, like, I really like Grace Lee Whitney in the role. I really like Janice Rand, but we see throughout the original series, the characters don't change that much. You know, you may get bits of Spock development throughout the series. Kirk is pretty much Kirk throughout the series. You know, Scotty is Scotty. I don't think you could sustain 3 seasons of Janice Rand kind of looking longingly at Kirk.
And, I hear that, and we also have her written out of the series quite early as well.
Yeah, and do you think, you know, when we get to Riker and Troy, this was essentially Roddenberry working with that sort of trope? Because, you know, we saw, you know, we had Ilya and Decker in the motion picture.
Yeah.
And then Riker and Troy in Next Generation, where it's two people that, look, we know Riker and Troy like each other, but they have separate romances, they have their own stories, their own lives. Do you think that he had anything in mind along those lines when essentially he created the character of Rand?
In what way? What do you mean?
Like, he saw, like, maybe a longer game where like, Rand was going to kind of develop her own inner life within the show? Because, you know,
I can see that, and I don't know about if it's a case of her own romances. I really think she's written a way in which she was meant to pine for the lead character.
Mm-hmm.
That would have made him, you know, seem like a guy full of kind of, charisma and, mm-hmm. and magnetism. And, you know, of course she can't, you know, stay away, but I think really what it's there for is to build tension between these two characters. It's part of drama. It's part of having this conflict. I think that's kind of what she was written to be, you mm-hmm. know? So I think there's a big lost opportunity with Janice Rand, but I don't want to give too much credit to these 1960s writers who I think were just clueless in a lot of ways about how to properly portray, like, women on television.
I also wonder, I mean, Roddenberry, you know, wanted this character in the show. Do you think the other writers really wanted her there? Because it doesn't seem like, you know, because a lot of the episodes of original series are written by different people than Roddenberry. And
he would take a pass over pretty much every script, for sure.
But she's very sporadic throughout her first, you know, through the first 13 episodes. And it's often, do you think the writers, a lot of them were just like, I don't know what to do with this character, just don't put her in this episode.
Yeah, it could just be contract things or availability things, because there's other characters I do recall kind of filling that role every so often.
Yeah.
But I do remember, David Gerrold's, when he wrote Trials and Tribulations, I believe he wanted her to appear on that season 2 episode. Tribulations, DS9.
You're still like a triple drunk after our triple episode a couple weeks ago.
I know. More tribbles, more troubles, man.
Yeah.
But with regards to this, like, David Gerrold, who was pretty much, it's like the fan mm-hmm. getting to write for the series, he wanted her back for season 2, and I believe Jean Coon said no, like, she's not with the series anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if I get the sense that the writers were as invested in her as maybe some of the fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would be curious to know actually how much fans loved this character at the time. I suspect she was probably quite popular.
Yeah, I think the difference between her and Uhura is I think the fact that you have a character like Uhura, who is like a woman of color, having like a professional job, like she's an officer aboard a starship, you know,
mm-hmm.
that's progressive right then and there. But you know, I think just having maybe, and let's be honest, it's a white woman,
mm-hmm.
you know, who has a job that I think many people could relate to, where you're doing a lot of this clerical stuff.
Yeah.
Maybe a lot of people, just because of the demographics of the United States at the time, say, oh, I can relate to Janice Rand quite a bit.
Right, and also the fact that in this era, women were fairly new to the workforce still, and probably would be doing jobs like Janice Rand. Like, people would be like, yes, that reminds me of, you know, like, sort of the woman in my office or whatever.
Yeah.
Would be doing that type of work. I don't know as many people, especially in that era, would have someone like Uhura in their office.
Correct.
Yeah. So, it does seem like Janice Rand was there for people to identify with at a certain point. Like, I do feel like the mindset of a 1960s man working in TV is like, women will identify with Rand because they will want to be with Captain Kirk.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
And do you think, so then, from that very, very outdated point of view, do you think Janice Rand works as, like, the wish fulfillment character for women?
I think she does not. She's too passive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's ultimately, back then, I can't tell you, there would have been, like, millions of women who would wanted to see not this passive actor, but, mm-hmm. you know, this active actor. And by actor, I don't mean a performer, but like
right.
a person, like an entity that's...
Has agency.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I think she's a very likable character,
mm-hmm.
but she, some amazing kind of progressive role model? No.
Yeah.
And I think, and the whole idea of this particular podcast is we're discussing what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's potential for her, for somebody who started off as maybe a rather, you know, passive character, to grow into something greater. But I just don't think the writers, if she stuck around for 3 seasons, the writers would have given her that.
Let's talk about one of the episodes where she has a lot to do, and that's the episode Miri.
Sure.
Miri will not go down in the books as anyone's favorite episode.
You like it for the pencil sharpening.
That scene is genius. Come on. But, you know, in the episode Miri, they go down to this planet, which kids are essentially the only inhabitants of, and there's a plague going around that wipes out adults. And we see it, you know, Janice Rand and Kirk are trying to figure out what's going on. At a certain point, she gets infected with this virus, and, you know, it has this moment where she's saying, like, to Kirk, you know, like, I'd always want you to, like, notice my legs or whatever. It's sort of this, like, from the point of view of 1966, I'm sure it was intended to be a very touching scene. And I can get that at least from the moment through the actors. Not necessarily the dialogue or the way that the scene comes across nowadays, but I understand what they were going for, and it probably worked in 1966.
Yeah.
To me, this is probably her moment where she's the most developed, at least in her relationship with Kirk.
Yeah.
And the episode is giving her a lot to do, but then it, like, takes, to me, like, a really weirdo turn, where suddenly it's like, she seems actively jealous of Miri, who's getting Kirk's attention.
Which is creepy in and of itself.
Yeah, and so we have this character that, like, we're finally getting to see her not delivering food or, you know, giving Kirk coffee or whatever.
Or a dietary salad.
That's pretty gold. Corbomite maneuver, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we get to see her actually in the field doing something, and then she's jealous of, like, a 12-year-old girl.
Yes.
And I don't think this... to me, this
it doesn't reflect well on the character.
No, exactly. Yeah, that's a perfect way to put it. Yeah, like, we at this point, we aren't really on Janice Rand's side. We're more like, what is wrong with this situation?
But I think the reason why it seems kind of egregious is because we see so much potential with Grace Lee Whitney's performance, as well as a character that would have been relatable to, for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what the big issue here, and something that I hate watching on television, is wasted potential.
Yeah.
And I think we see that a lot with Janice Rand. How did you feel, you know, because I realized you watched the films first and then went mm-hmm. back and got into the original series. Knowing that, I mean, how did you feel about seeing her, you know, go through the ranks of Starfleet and become a far more empowered person to the point that she's essentially has Uhura's job aboard the USS Excelsior?
Well, I must say, like, I'd seen the movies in advance. I had no idea who Janice Rand was.
I'm in the same boat as you.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
It meant absolutely nothing to me, honestly. Like, I don't think it was until after I'd maybe watched maybe all of the original series or whatever that I suddenly realized she had cameos.
Yeah.
In the rest. And I was very excited to discover those cameos and see her in roles of authority and ultimately, yeah, as a communications officer. It really bothers me that, you know, her first appearance back in the motion picture is overseeing the worst transporter accident known to man.
Again, it's not giving her as much agency as we'd like to see.
No, nor does her cameo in Star Trek III as credited, Woman in Cafeteria.
Okay.
And in Star Trek IV, like, she has a blinker and or you'll miss it moment is, like, Commander Rand. She's credited as Commander at that point. That's something.
I think she announces that there's 95% cloud cover above Juneau, Alaska.
Yeah.
Because of the probe.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so then flashback, man. Star Trek Voyager flashback.
Yeah. Bee's knees.
Is that Rand at her best?
I might say the first...
Her most empowered, Cam.
Most empowered, yes. Okay. By far, yes. That is, yeah, no question at all. I guess it was never going to be an option that Rand was going to be a major presence within the movies. Because, I mean, Nurse Chapel is a far bigger role on the original series.
Yeah.
And she's barely in the movies at all.
Yeah.
You know,
and so, she's married to the man in charge.
At least for the first movie.
He did not die, but as you're alluding to, Gene Roddenberry's kind of kick to the curb. Yeah. Following the motion picture.
Yeah, he was, like, writing those feverish Spock kills JFK scripts.
Yeah.
For the next, like, four movies.
Okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, I really would have liked to have seen Janice Rand contribute in a more meaningful way. Do you think nowadays, if a character had been written out that early in a series and was brought back for movies, do you think they would give this character in the movies more to do than they did, you know, in 79 through 91, where Janice Rand just pops up momentarily?
Like, if, say, the film came out in 2016 after being off the air for 10 years?
Yeah.
Yeah, because, honestly, I think there's such a fan culture nowadays that just did not exist, you know, 30, 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you'd get, like, these kind of, like, hey, I know that character, it had potential, let's insert them into this movie, and instead of getting some no-name to do this particular action, we'll give a nod to the head to fans who appreciated this person.
What do you think stands out more to fans, the Rand cameos or the Barclay cameo in First Contact?
Oh, I definitely say Barclay cameo.
Yeah, you think so?
Far and away. I remember being in theater when Barclay appeared on screen. I didn't actually know that he was going to be in the film. And, like, as soon as he was on screen, like, there's an audible, like, kind of elation coming from the crowd. I even remember somebody going, "This guy..." Yeah, they didn't even know his name, but, like, yeah. So I honestly think Barclay just more recognizable. It wasn't like as jarring a time frame change from, like, 1960s fashions to a 1979 fashion,
right?
So, yeah, I definitely think that Barkley cameo maybe did it a little bit better.
Of the Rand cameos, it just doesn't feel like she gets to, you know, I'm not saying give her 20 minutes of screen time, but, like, give her, a memorable line or something.
Yeah, okay, so, but then let's, no pun intended, let's flash forward to flashback, mm-hmm. where that is kind of fan service.
Yes.
Right there. They are giving her more to do. She doesn't have that much to do in that episode, but mm-hmm. I think that's more akin to, the writers wanting to give her like a good solid shout out versus what we got in the films,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
which I honestly think, yes, I guess giving her woman in cafeteria credit, it'll
that's cold.
It is, you know, you could just, but at least somebody like in the production staff were like, hey, let's get, you know, Grace Lee Whitney to do this particular job.
And that stuff. Was also Nimoy who directed that film.
Yeah.
And he had a closer relationship with her on set anyway.
So that, it was probably him who's like, hey, look, I'll put you in this scene as opposed to some random that I've never encountered before.
I mean, the fact that she shows up in...
I honestly don't even remember her in that film.
Yeah. The fact that she shows up, though, in cameos in the two films he directed... And the film he produced or co-produced,
yeah.
with Undiscovered Country. She doesn't show up in 5, which is interesting. I don't really know the reasons for that.
Shatner is in the director's seat.
Yeah, I don't really know if that means anything, but it's...
Well, but by then, was this one of the few films that did not take place on Earth and in the Star Trek film canon?
Yeah, it is.
And so by then, she was no longer assigned to the Enterprise, so mm-hmm. I think that's... The simple answer is
right,
why.
Right. Yeah. Let's talk about the idea of like a character, a season one character, being removed from a show, because we see this with Denise Crosby in
right.
TNG. Now, look, I don't want to fault a show for maybe deciding a character isn't working and moving on, because shows take a while to find their legs. Sometimes what's designed from the pilot falls off. You know, I've been rewatching Seinfeld. In the first episode, Elaine is not there. There is a waitress there, a waitress character. Who is written out immediately after that episode.
And we're going to be doing a podcast on her next week. So,
obviously.
Yeah, please tune in.
So the idea of maybe deciding a character isn't working is fair game, I think. The circumstances surrounding Grace Lee Whitney's exit from the show are not fair game at all. But, you know, Denise Crosby would have similar frustrations that really Grace Lee Whitney was going through. The idea of this character who's supposed to be a big deal... coming in and having very little to do.
I go back to this quote from Will Wheaton. Mm-hmm. I think it was on his blog, and he was saying that he was just such a young guy. He didn't realize that, yeah, the writers, once they settle on the fact that they prefer writing for the Picard, Riker, Data triumvirate, that's just what they're going to lean towards. He shouldn't have taken it as personally as he did back
right.
in the day. And... Denise Crosby, look, she's a young actress at the time. She felt as if there were more opportunities for her than to literally just spout exposition all
right.
the time. So I think part of it is like the writers, look, they gave her a shot at the very beginning. I thought Tasha Yar was going to have, look, if you had only ever seen Encounter on Farpoint,
mm-hmm.
you would have thought that Tasha Yar season one would have way more to do than she actually did.
Right, yeah.
So, look, I don't blame her for wanting to leave the series, but... You know, how early on do you think it was that they kind of settled on writing primarily for Picard, Riker, and Data? I think it was pretty early.
I think, like Janice Rand, it was very quickly.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, and so, like, you have these characters that kind of flail about and are very popular with fans. Tasha Yar, you know, you go to a convention, Denise Crosby is loved at conventions.
Yeah.
People really like Tasha Yar a lot. She was an important figure for a lot of women.
She had this great story about she was taking... elevator down 30 Rock with Nirvana after they performed on SNL.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, Dave Grohl's in the elevator, and he's like, you're Tasha Yar!
Yeah.
You know, just, like, just stuff like that. It's fun to hear.
Why do you think this scenario that these two actresses went through never played out with a male character in Star Trek?
Well, let me propose this. And I think it's a very good question. And it's always hard to compare scenarios as if they aren't apples and oranges, because
mm-hmm.
it could be that way, but look, Chakotay, Harry,
yeah.
Harry Kim,
yeah.
did those characters work? Tuvok, Well, maybe I won't necessarily throw Tuvok in there, but I don't think Chakotay, Harry Kim really work as characters, as well-defined characters that they gave a lot to do.
Sure, I think you can go to our Loser Leads episode to hear more about those two.
Sure.
But I think the difference is, though, like, as much as I agree 100%, Chakotay and Harry Kim are pretty bland a lot of the time. Those writers are still trying a lot of the time. Like, or maybe not trying, but they're like, they feel they have to give these characters lines or scenes or whatever.
Well, here's the thing. Like, look, if Denise Crosby stuck it out, she still would have been in Next Generation seasons 2 through 7.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that would have been the case for all the actresses, because of course we know that through her own volition, one Gates McFadden, she left in season 2.
Yeah.
And one Marina Sirtis was told that she was going to get the boot,
yeah,
if not for the fact that those other two women had actually already, you know, handed in their papers and left the series as well.
Right.
You bring up a good point, Cam. Why is this only on women? And we see that with Jennifer Lean, with her departure. Yeah.
There's a whole, that could be another episode, too. I'm actually a big fan of Cass.
Yeah, she had to make way for the far more, you know, typical, like, sex symbol character to come in. And then when, and totally different circumstances in each one of these that I'm laying out here. But then, of course, we do have one Terry Farrell. She wants to take another job on Becker.
Right.
So she departs in a very unceremonious sort of way.
Yeah, that one's less egregious to me, given the circumstances of why she wanted to leave. And it's not like Jadzia was being underwritten.
Yeah.
But yes, the way she goes out is pretty lame.
Yes. So look, but we never have any men written out, prematurely. Not even one Travis Mayweather.
Right.
And I do apologize, listeners, I believe I referred to him as Travis Merriweather, during the last episode.
Did you really?
I think I did.
Okay.
Sure. That was his original name, though.
Yeah, right.
And so I always get it mixed up because, like, in my head, going back 10 plus years, like, up until, like, I think just a few weeks before it premiered, they're like, oh, no, his name is Mayweather now.
Right.
Anyway, sorry, but even with a character, like, he had absolutely nothing to do.
Yeah.
Like, do you think he is a more thankless character than Chakotay and Kim? I do. I think he had less to do than Kim or
yes,
Chakotay.
For sure.
Because there's a certain point that they would not even give, they'd give Hoshi at least one, you know, Hoshi episode a season. And they weren't doing that for Mayweather.
I remember, too, like, when the show, like, when I started watching season 1 of Enterprise, I remember, like, actually really liking the character of Hoshi right out of the gate.
Yeah.
She was, I thought Linda Park was very charismatic, and I thought added something.
It's the only time you've ever heard that from Camp.
Anyways, you know, I really like that character.
I like Hoshi. Yeah. I agree. If you ever go to a convention, you'll get the reference.
Right.
Anyways.
Yeah. So, but, you know, so the first handful of episodes, I'm really liking Hoshi because she's a character I haven't seen on the show. Usually the characters are very composed on Star Trek, a little stilted. Whereas Hoshi is none of those things, and she has sort of like almost a youthful energy that you just don't see on the show. I mean, Wesley Crusher was like a teenager written by old men. So, yeah. Like, I just was like, this is kind of ridiculous. But, like, Hoshi felt a little authentic to me. And the show just quickly, like, gets bored and is kind of like Rand, like Denise Crosby's character Tasha Yar. It's like I don't understand why they struggled to write these characters, because I don't think on paper these characters are disposable.
I think it goes back to the writers' room.
Mm-hmm.
Who was beyond, say, Jake Sisko?
Yeah.
Were there any characters that were just forgotten about on Deep Space Nine?
No.
Exactly. And the thing is, with Jake Sisko, I don't think he was ever meant to be, like, in every single episode.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't. Like, he was originally supposed to be recurring.
Mm-hmm.
They liked Sirach Lofton enough to put him in the main credits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, like, the writers really were determined to make all these characters work.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They were able to get these actors. And I think we know from going to these conventions, Cam, that, like, there's a reason why these actors were hired in the first place.
Right.
Like, Robert Beltran, say what you will about Chakotay the character, that's a charismatic guy up on stage.
Yeah.
Same with Garrett Wong, who played Kim.
Mm-hmm.
So, the writer's room, it plays a big, big part in this debate that we're having.
Yeah. I mean, when this show, so going back to 66 when they're writing Star Trek, how many of the characters do you think they were invested in off the top? I feel
two.
Like, you think just Kirk and Spock, right?
Yeah.
Because even Bones takes a while to kind of take his place with the tree as among the trio.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Is this a way that 60 television was done? I don't really even know that well.
I just think it's a good conversation to have. But like, you know, people look at diversity in television today,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of, you know, I always find it weird that we still have like entire casts made up only of like white people on shows, because it just doesn't reflect reality. Nobody cared like back in the 1960s.
It
was just like there's no effort to have any sort of diversity as well. So it look, yes, 60s television, that was just the way of thinking, whether diversity in gender, diversity in races. But I say that in Star Trek at least had, you know, a lot of those characters visible.
Right.
Not necessarily well-developed characters, but they were visible on, say, the bridge, the corridors, what have you.
Mm-hmm. And you would see, like, Uhura taking major spots in episodes. Maybe not necessarily consistently, but you would see in, like, Gamesters of Triskelion or Plato's Stepchildren.
Yeah.
She would be featured in the main storyline. So, yes, awesome, and that was very progressive for the time and deserves, you know, championing. But it does really bother me that, you know, Janice Rand is intended as to fill out the trio, essentially, of the original series. And this is following the failed pilot for The Cage, where you have Majel Barrett as number one, who is a character who's, you know, major role within, you know, the ship. And they decide, well, we're going to have essentially the equivalent of the space secretary.
Yeah, well, and that's coming down from the executives.
Yes.
And the thing is, they made a big deal about, like, she's not like other women,
because
she's smart, apparently. It was like, it was very bizarre how they set up number one.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know exactly what they were trying to say, other than to show us she's incredibly competent.
Right.
And that makes her different.
Yeah.
It was very strange.
Yes.
But, dude, it's like, it's that 60s mentality of like, a lot of these, like, I don't know, like, ego-driven guys who I don't know if they're the most progressive executives out there,
mm-hmm.
who said, no, this is just weird, we're not going to have, like, these empowered women
right
over the show, so.
And, you know, so you get this character, Janice Rand, who, you know, we've said, sort of like a fantasy figure for women, also a real fantasy figure for, the, I'm sure, the male executives. You know, this beautiful blonde woman who's always making, you know, moon eyes at the male character who I'm sure the men are identifying with. Which is also really weird.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's a tribute to Grace Lee Whitney and as how much layers of depth she brings to this character. Because, I mean, can you imagine this character with, like, a less capable actress? It would have been... would be talking about this as one of the greatest lowlights of the franchise, I think.
I even wonder if she would have made it 8 episodes.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, I think of, like, the episode Balance of Terror. I think this is a really... This might be my favorite Janice Rand episode, even though she doesn't get...
She's very much damsel in distress in that one as well.
She is, but there's moments in it that I think really convey something that is deep for the character. I think maybe not even intended by the directors or the writers. But there's, like, the moment at the start where, like, her and Kirk are, you know, Kirk's officiating the wedding. And you just see, like, Janice Rand's expression, where she's kind of looking back and forth between kind of the couple and Kirk. And, you know, it's sort of presenting that sort of text of the series, which is her kind of being pulled towards Kirk and, you know, can't do that because of the lifestyle she has. But I think, like, I think Grace Lee Whitney brings so much to just that silent moment that I'm like, that's actually really, like, it means something. Like, there's emotion behind it.
Yeah.
And there's also a moment later in that episode where, you know, Kirk is exhausted and whatever during mid-battle, and he goes into his room, and she goes into the room without knocking or whatever just to check on him, and he's, like, laying down, and she's essentially portraying a role that would be similar to what Troy would do later, where she's essentially a counselor. And, you know, it's not, you know, Bones walking into Kirk's room going, like, hey, Jim, how are you holding up? You know, it's like Janice Rand is the one who can kind of get Kirk kind of calm down and get him back out there. And I think... It's moments like that that I think the text, you have to bring a lot of it to yourself. I don't know that the show was like, here's the moment where we really develop Janice Rand.
Yeah.
You know, but, and there's that moment too where, like, they're in fear and she kind of comes up behind Kirk and he's kind of shielding her. to me, like, I mean, this is, look, I think we can agree, Balance of Terror is one of the greatest episodes of the original series.
Yeah, no doubt.
I feel like it brings about the best to Janice Rand that the show is able to within the context. I think Grace Lee Whitney gets far more to do in other episodes, but I think those episodes ultimately kind of turn on her as a character.
And it just comes, I think, back down to a passive agent versus mm-hmm. an active agent. Mm-hmm. And it's, if they gave her that active agency, then it would be an entirely different conversation that we're having right now.
It's true. And, you know, you reference number one. I mean, that's the difference, is she was an active character.
Exactly, yeah.
And Janice Rand is not. She's there to be a supportive character to, you know, essentially nursemaid Kirk back to, you know, health or back onto the bridge and let him do what he's good at.
Yeah. Well, so, Cam, to summarize here, when you think of the character Janice Rand, is it somebody that you think that potential could have been fully realized if, you know, the circumstances surrounding Grace Lee Whitney, her departure from the show, did not come to be? Or do you think there was just something holding back this character that kind of was very pervasive throughout 1960s society?
I think Janice Rand is very much a victim of her time.
Yeah.
I think this is a character that...
But how come we're not necessarily having that same conversation about Uhura?
That's an excellent question. I think because Uhura was not a character who was introduced as someone whose major defining characteristic was her love for Kirk.
Yeah.
She was a woman, essentially, in the first handful of episodes she's in, who was there doing her job and playing music, you know, in the recreation room and kind of teasing Spock or whatever. Like
Uhura.
Yes, Uhura. Yeah. Yeah. She was someone who had kind of a spark of personality. Like, she wasn't someone who's... You know, we did see Rand kind of, you know, goofing around a little bit with Sulu and stuff like that, but we never got to see her do a lot with the rest of the crew. Like, Rand was never really portrayed as a member of the crew. She was portrayed as Kirk's...
Secretary,
yeah. Right? Like, she was never joining the other crew in their duties. She was always standing behind Kirk or following Kirk, you know, with his diet salads or whatever. She did not have a role that allowed her to do that. And so I think she falls victim to the times where you have this character who's not in a position to even succeed. Because, again, what do you do with 3 seasons of a character who's a secretary, essentially?
Yeah.
Unless you're willing to be a little, think outside the box, and I don't think in 1966 they would be.
So bring it back around.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have Yeoman on Star Trek Discovery? Is this something that they realized, you're going to rope somebody into what's inevitably a very passive sort of role, you know? And I'm not, like, it doesn't have to be a woman playing mm-hmm. this role. It could be mm-hmm. a guy. And I'm not saying that somebody who's doing, like, secretarial work is doomed to be some sort of passive character, but I just wonder if they're going to skip the whole idea of Yeoman altogether.
I would imagine so. I don't think you're going to see any of them.
Yeah.
Do you?
No. But I could be wrong.
Do you think you could have, though, a dynamic, essential secretary character in Star Trek? I think you can in lots of other series. I think other series support that type of character. I don't know that Star Trek does.
And I think the issue is because Star Trek portrays humans as such, like, kind of superhuman characters now.
Mm-hmm.
It's very jarring to see somebody in almost a Richard Bashir sort of role. You know?
Yeah.
Not to demean anybody on a starship, but it's like, Janice Rand's job wasn't the most important mm-hmm. aboard the ship. It wasn't critical to the functions of the ship.
And I don't think anyone at home was sitting forward being like, I want to know more about what that character does.
Right.
Whereas, like, Uhura, they see the earpiece, she's at a computer system, they're going like, what's that, you know, like, how does that work?
Well, yeah, and you would have had women of color saying, oh, sure. She's inspiring me to do this. Yeah, mm-hmm. We always hear, you know, people go up to Gates McFadden and say, you inspired me, a woman, to go become a doctor or go become a scientist. I know I'm going to sound like such a jerk, or you know, but I don't think people are going to Grace Lee Whitney saying, like, you inspired me to do clerical work.
Right.
You know, and which isn't to dismiss that character, who I think had all this lost potential that we're speaking of here. So, and I'm going to say it for, like, the fourth or fifth time, but it just comes down to, like, the agency that this character had.
Yeah.
And wasn't that much.
Yeah, and, you know, when we say that, we aren't in any way speaking down about Grace Lee Whitney's performance, who I think has so much charisma. And I think one of the greatest crimes is that, you know, this awful incident happened to her, and we never got to see her kind of really perform, you know, be an actress in this period that much longer. And she would just kind of disappear and just show up in cameos going forward. You know, she's in an episode of, like, Batman around that period, in a King Tut episode, which is pretty fun. But, you know, I think she was capable of far more than that era was willing to allow her to do on television. And, you know, we obviously got far more Nichelle Nichols down the road, which, of course, is a great thing. And, I'm, you know, I'm glad that happened. But I think it's really sad what happened to Rand. Now, I'm curious, do you think the future will hold any opportunities for Rand to be featured again in Star Trek? You know, the JJ verse hasn't introduced her, but could it happen?
No, I think at this point, look, if you do the timeline in the JJ universe, then she would not have been old enough up until this point to be aboard the starship.
But was Chekhov at that point?
No, because no. Remember, Chekhov was like the boy genius.
Yeah.
So he's like 17 when he was aboard that, and that actor would have been older, or sorry, that character would have been older than Janice Rand. Mm-hmm. I would say at that point, anyway. So it's been 7 years. So Janice Rand would actually, at this point, be the right age to be on the ship.
Could she show up in the fourth one?
No, not at all.
That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's unfortunate, but yeah, I mean, Janice Rand, as we said, you know, I think it's probably the most tragic character of, you know, a tragic handling of a character, I think, in the franchise. Would you agree, or do you hold someone else?
Well, I need to be honest, though. She's a minor character.
Yeah.
You know, she's a, like, and she's, it's kind of an obscure character. So, mm-hmm. Tragic handling. I think the circumstances surrounding her departure are certainly the most, like, tragic and traumatic. Like, mm-hmm. The actress's departure. Of course, but I think the handling of, say, Denise Crosby, as well as Jennifer Lean, mm-hmm. like, I think those were more egregious because they were main characters.
Right, yeah. So, yeah. Okay, and yeah, one of my greatest regrets was in the last convention I went to that Grace Lee Whitney was alive, I was going to get her autograph on the last day, and then I was like, I just didn't have time.
All right.
And I said, okay, you know what, I'll get it next year. And it didn't work out,
unfortunately.
And so that's kind of one of my biggest Star Trek convention regret. But, you know, she was a lot of fun on stage. And again, in what she had to work with, I think she was performed well above and beyond what was probably even maybe expected at the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Send your thoughts and feedback to subspacetransmissionspod@gmail.com. I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on Janice Rand. You know, maybe moments and episodes that stood out to you, or how this character impacted you and what little time she had. Now, Tyler, what are we doing next week?
We're going to do another review of a two-part episode, Deep Space Nine, The Search, Parts 1 and 2. We've got a very special guest joining us for the month of December. Can't believe the year's almost over, but we've got some good episodes ahead, and I think you and I have been discussing it. We'll kick off the year in a fun fashion as well. So mm-hmm. Definitely keep tuning in.
That's right. Okay, so you can also reach us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Voyager, the episode Flashback. Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's RAPORTONN as in number one has agency.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.